Today's edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you in part by NEC. NEC Corporation is a leading provider and integrator of IT and networking technologies around the world. NEC's OpenFlow-based software-defined networking fabric, Programmable Flow, radically simplifies network design and management, increases network performance and predictability, speeds innovation, and dramatically reduces the cost of network operations. Visit NEC Corporation of America on the web at www.necam.com/pflow and download a free white paper from IDC on designing networks with OpenFlow, or contact your NEC representative today for more information on how an OpenFlow-enabled network fabric can solve your networking challenges. Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show published weekly or so featuring technology, guests, and opinions from the data networking industry. On Packet Pushers, people like me who build networks for a living gather in the virtual conference room to talk about what we do. If FEX pinning has been on your mind, if security log correlation is a problem you've got, if OpenFlow has you curious, or if you've been planning your company's IPv6 deployment, you have tuned into the right place. So I am Ethan Banks, network engineer, CCIE, and blogger at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks, where I tweet nerdy, and add me to your circles on Google+, where I post links to interesting articles as well as info related to this show. Also with us, of course, is Mr. Greg Farrow. And Greg, how are you, sir?
Great intro. What a fantastic intro. I'm fine.
You like that, huh?
You caught me on the hop there, yeah. I've been cackling to myself since you did it. My finger's been on the mute button going, wah, wah. I'm okay. Funny sort of a week. I'm out of work again. So I've been at home working on some odd writing projects and getting caught up on some blogging. We did the webinar this week for on Round OpenFlow. And so it's been a busy sort of a busy, unbusy sort of a week. Strange things.
Now, that OpenFlow seminar that you did, that's the webinar is heading on to ipspace.net, right?
That's right. So it was done in partnership with Ivan, Ivan Peponiak from ipspace.net as part of his webinars. And then later it was sponsored by Big Switch, so we could make it free to everybody. And if you keep a watch, keep a close eye on Packet Pushers, we will post a link to it there.
Yeah, I know folks are asking about that. There's a lot of folks that mentioned that they had attended it on Twitter. And then they said, hey, when can I see the whole thing again? So, yep, a notice will go out.
Yes.
So, you know what I spent my morning doing? It was Nexus stuff. I'm getting ready to buy a bunch of Nexus gear. And so I had my Visio out and I had my Nexus stencils out and I'm doing detail wire maps because I am not going to forget an optic this time. It seems like every time I've done a big project like this, some amount of optics gets forgotten to be ordered somewhere along the line. This time...
Use those short reach optics. Make sure you get the bundles that have the short reach optics in them.
There's bundles. The FEX bundles come with the FETs. Those are the special little ones just to uplink to a 5K or a 7K from a FEX.
Right, they're called ultra short reach optics. Basically, they're like a, as far as I can tell, and there's not a lot of information on what they are. They're an early concept from the Ethernet thing when the idea was that you could just have it strip down all the stuff that Ethernet doesn't need and then power it at low power and it'll go, what, 30 meters something?
Something like that. I forget the exact distance, but it is 100 meters, but they're special in the sense that they are, I believe they're only available through a bundle, and then when you deploy them, the Cisco switch is very particular about what you do with them. You can't just use it as a regular Ethernet optic. It has to be used to uplink to FX.
Right. So to be compatible with Ethernet, it had to have certain things in it. So the Ethernet standard is full of cruft. You know, just stuff is all piled in there that needs to do stuff. If really all you want to do is have Ethernet go between two switches, you can take out all this stuff, and that's what the ultra short reach optic is. And as a result, it's like 1/10 the price of a standard optic, and not compatible. It's not Ethernetable, but it runs on the same fiber as everything else. Runs at 100 meters. It's just cheap. And the reason Cisco doesn't sell them as an independent line item, because I asked, is Cisco wants to encourage customer behavior.
Yeah, exactly right. So There's been a person listening in the background here to us prattle on about NEX and FEX and FET and so on, and that person's name is Todd Lammel. Now, a few weeks ago, I asked the Packet Pushers LinkedIn group to tell me who they'd like to hear on the show during 2012 that we've never had before, and Todd's name came up. So he and I connected, and he agreed to come on the show today, and we're going to have a chat today with Todd about certifications, networking, career stuff, and that kind of thing, which has got to be the single most frequent topic that that Greg and I get in the packetpushers at gmail.com mailbox. So, Todd, welcome to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell folks what you do and so on.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Greg. And my last name is actually pronounced Lammel, just so you know. Most people call me something different, but as long as everyone keeps right, Jack's spelled correctly, I'm good to go.
Lammel, yes, sir.
Lammel, yeah, whatever. So, anyways, what was the question?
Well, tell everybody who you are, yeah.
Oh, okay. My name is Todd Lammel, and I've been in networking now 30 years. I started in 1981 at Atari on December 7th, 1981, so I just hit my 30 year. I did go out drinking a lot that day. I was teaching a class in Dallas on December 7th, and I was like, holy moly, I've been doing this way too long. But anyways, I think I got known. I started in 1995. I started writing TCP/IP books for Microsoft Technologies, and then I wrote a Cisco book in 97. It published the beginning of 1998. And right when we were going to publishing, I had just wrote an administrator handbook. I was network administrator at AAA at the time. And I had quite a few people, like 300 or so administrators working all over the country. And no one knew what Cisco was or how to set a host name. I know that sounds ridiculous today, but actually there was absolutely no books out, no pamphlets, nothing on their website, anything like that. So I'm just going as simple as possible. This is the absolute truth. So I wrote a handbook on just things I wanted my administrators to be able to do, you know, all the way from we were using frame relay and, you know, ISDN and some other technologies, SMDS, if you can believe that. But anyways, we were using nothing but Cisco. And so I wrote this book, and I was going to publish. I went to my publisher. We're going to publish it. And right before we went to print, the Cisco announced CCNA. So I went and looked at the objectives, waited for the test to come out, took the test. My book lined up pretty much 90%. So we came off presses. I rewrote it in a few weeks, and then that was the best-selling book ever. I put that out. There was no other Cisco book out for at least 2 years. So I sold quite a few books, and I hit the timing right, and I wrote it, you know, in an easy-to-read manner because I was actually writing it as a to-do manual for my administrators. And so that's kind of how I got known, I would say. But, you know, I've been working I worked in nothing but Fortune 500 companies. I worked at Xerox for 7.5 years, and I was network manager at AAA. I'm sorry, before that at Hughes Aircraft in El Segundo, then in San Francisco at AAA. So before that, Atari and then CompuCorp and a few other electronic technicians. I was an electronic technician because we didn't have computers. Really.
Yes, there was a time, children, before computers.
Yes. I still tell my kid I had to go all the way through college on a typewriter. And I said, we didn't have the internet, you know. And when we used to go to the internet in the mid-90s or whatever, it was just for work. He's like, what? And then I said, yeah, and there was no porn. He's like, what? Flipping out, you know, so. Anyway,
I remember getting up because I was many, many years ago, I lived in Australia, and to get access to device drivers, we would actually get up at midnight to get cheap dial-up access to America to download drivers for laser printers.
Yeah, like CompuServe, I think it was. That was the only thing we'd dial up in bulletin boards to get drivers for our CD-ROMs.
That was a miracle because the only other way was to order them and wait for them to ship.
That's absolutely correct. It was just for work. So I think we can understand how the designers of IP version 4 and so on wasted, you know, what, 3 billion addresses. You know what I mean? Because who was going to use it? Anyways, and so the last probably, gosh, since 97, 98, I was on my own, started a consulting company in 97. And so I've been basically on my own since then. And still going with GlobalNet Training Consulting is my main corporation. I still have Lammel Press and Lammel.com and so on, where I do publishing and, you know, self-study stuff, but I still write every year. I just published a new Network Plus book. I know that's probably be a little low for everyone on this, but it's a great seller. You do things for money sometimes, and Network Plus is a really, really great selling book.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to do better selling a Network Plus book versus CCIE books just aren't going to sell as well, and that there's not that many people trying to take that test.
No, I'll sell 150,000 books. Where CCIE sell 1,500 or 2,500 or 5,000 if it's really good. It's hard to sell. Ethan and I were having this conversation, Greg, before we got on, and about how hard it is to sell books today. And I transitioned into training. It was just by, it just happened. Everything that happened in my life happened because I was trying to do something else. I had these brilliant ideas of opening these companies and making some widget or this or that, networking stuff, computer stuff, electronics, whatever. And then I actually had a software company called RouterSim. I don't know if you guys had ever heard about that. It was the first Cisco router simulator out there for a while, but I sold that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it came out and we sold a lot. I did really well with that. And it was the .com. So .coms were good. .coms were good back then. But anyways, I sold the company, say, 5-6 years ago, which I'm glad I did. I sold it as soon as I heard Cisco was coming out with a free package racer. So anyways, there's still some other simulators out there. But nonetheless, I've done a lot of things. And, I never wanted to open a training company. That was never my goal. And, funny story, I'll tell you my history. When I was at Xerox, I had gone in there as kind of electronic technician. And we were working on mainframes and things like that, IBM, Honeywell, and Sperry. I was just telling Ethan how bad my memory is. In 1985, okay, I was back there, and this company comes into Xerox, and we had an SNA system, right? We had an X.25 satellite network that we were connecting up. Oh, gosh. At least 10,000 sites. Maybe it was more. I can't remember. All over the world. Maybe it was 20,000. I mean, we had a ton of VSATs. Anyways, so we needed a gateway system to connect our SNA network to our X.25. Nothing existed. Well, this couple comes in, which ended up to be Lynn and Sandy Bozak, and they were called San Francisco Systems at the time, by the way. So a lot of people speculate that that was the truth, but I swear it was. I was there. They came into Xerox and sold us this gateway system for $150,000. And, I was young then. I think 25, whatever. Go back to 1985 and minus 50, so whatever. and so all the people working on the mainframe and everything, because I'm like, I want to work on a mainframe. I want some future, thinking, I wanted to work on hell, basically.
Yeah.
And, I wanted to get out of electronics and work on computers. I figured that was the way. And we were doing fiber muxes or muxes. They weren't fiber, but they were called that.
I remember that, in those days, I was also a circuit jockey. And I was just soldering chips from a motherboard and fixing power supplies and, oscilloscopes and voltmeters and logic probes on chips and tracking down, all that sort of good stuff. And it just seems and really, when you got a new computer, the first time you had a computer and you took the board apart, it was like a real challenge to work out how everything went. But after about a year of fixing them, you realize that actually there was always just one chip down the back that always blew, and if you replaced it, you'd fixed 80% of the problems.
You know what? That's absolutely true. When I worked at Atari, I was a young kid, and they hired me as Atari. I was just starting school in electronics. I told them I was about to finish, and I had just started. I'm in there, blowing up boards, and I'm working on pinball machines, and I can't remember what they had, Tetra or whatever. And they had these little computers, actually. But after – like you said, after about 3-4 months or maybe 6 months, every time whatever person they brought it in, it was always the same problem. So you almost didn't need to troubleshoot anymore.
But yeah, the earliest version of the XT motherboard was always the LS244 line drivers, or on the serial, the serial interface where there was an RS4, there was a chip 8255, and it always, it's not the 8250.
You guys know that about 80% of the audience has no idea what either of you are talking about right now.
Greg is, Greg is telling his agent, and he has a really damn good memory, I'll tell you that right now. All right, so let me get started on my Cisco history. And one of the questions, Ethan, you were asking me, do you find that luck or self-discipline is part of, a career?
Well, this is a career, this is a big career question, because a lot of things that sometimes people look at guys that have made it in career or whatever they perceived is to have made it in networking. They got their CCAE, whatever they did. And it's like, oh, you were lucky. Oh, it was handed to you. Oh, you're, you know, you got a friend that kind of worked it out for you or whatever. And that's one perspective. But the perspective I've always taken is one of there's work and self-discipline that's tied up in making headway in computer networking. It's freaking hard to keep up with it all. It's hard to understand it all.
I did mine opposite. Like, so in 82 to 84. In 84, Ethernet II came down. I was working at Xerox, and they're like, yo, young blood, go work on this new Ethernet. So I'm like, I didn't want to, but I was forced into doing that. You know, so that was more of an opportunity that I didn't want to be forced into it. Then, you know, I started working with Lynn Bozak on the Gateway, and I kept working on that. You know, the interesting thing about Cisco between 85 and 1990, the operating system was more like Linux, and people were changing things and people were adding things. And so remember, I mean, not like Linux today, but Linux, say 10, 15 years ago, where people, it was an open source. For example, we'd get couriers because there was no such thing as email or anything like that. Couriers would show up once a month with this 8.5 floppy that we'd put in here. And one time I got it and had, you know, the operating system had DECnet on it because someone added it, you know, some person. So it was more of an open source at that time, an interesting because it was just a bastardized Linux, and still is. But and they're even going back to that, right, with your Nexus products. But anyways, so it was funny because they offered me a job, and like I think it was late 1989, but they couldn't pay me. They didn't really have any money, so they were going to give me stock options. And they went public in 1990, but they weren't on the NASDAQ. So if anyone looks up this history, I'm telling you the truth here. Do you know how much their stock went for? So they were going to pay me in stock. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm a kid. I don't have any money. You know,
stock is like money in no tangible way.
Yeah, but you know how many of those companies come and go, right? The odds were against them.
Strongly, yeah.
They went up in 1990. They went on the penny stock, and their stock originally opened at 8 cents. That's when they named themselves Cisco Systems. So anyway, so I was working with them, and that's when they came out with their first what they called Alphabet Soup products, and most people have heard of those, AGS, MGS, IGS, and so on. So I started working with those, and then I got hired because I had worked on those. The only person that most people knew that had worked on them, I got hired as network manager at Hughes Aircraft. So after working at Xerox, I went and worked at Hughes, and for, gosh, there was 30,000 people I was supporting, I think. After I worked there, people were begging me to come work at wherever else, and I took a job at AAA. I'm kind of giving you a faster history now since I had slowed down earlier. But anyway, so a lot had happened between then, and I learned a lot about, you know, routing. Of course, we were using Token Ring and LAN Manager and all that other crap, but, you know, we got stuck with
Token Ring. Token Ring was kind of a brilliant idea, but the execution was so poor, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, IBM mismanaged it to death. What do you expect? So they had that tropical chipset on that. Remember that thing that they sold? And I mean, we were buying cards for $1,200, Token Ring cards, because that tropical chipset that they had on there. If anybody knows what I'm talking about, it's that you see open a Token Ring card, there's this metal plate on there, and it has that IBM proprietary chip in there. Anyways,
one that was guaranteed to work.
But one of the things, so if I can go forward to your luck versus self-discipline and what you brought up and what happened to me, it wasn't luck. You know, some of it I didn't want to do. It happened. There's no doubt about it. But there was, remember, at this time, there was no certifications. I was still going to school at UCLA. So I wanted to get my education from UCLA, you know, working on the typewriters we discussed. But, you know, if I don't really believe in luck, what basically there is self-discipline and there's opportunities. People might say to me, well, you got really lucky. You did this, this, and this. Let me tell you something. There's been no luck in my life. It's been nothing but hard work. I've worked 14 hours a day for 20 years, 7 days a week, you know, just working, working, working. So I work way too hard. And, you know, I'm writing. If I'm not writing, I'm consulting. If I'm not consulting, I'm teaching. If I'm not teaching, I'm running my companies, you know. So it's a nonstop process, you know. It's hard. But I don't – you know, people that said people got lucky because they did X, Y, and Z, that's just their excuse for not working.
Well, you can create your own luck, as I say it. So if you if you're working for a company and they need somebody who's going to take on a new technology, and they look around at the people in the team and they have to make a choice. Do they use somebody from within the team or do they take it from outside the team? If nobody in the team's got the gumption or nobody in the team's got the basic knowledge or the boss in charge is going to say, actually, you know, John over there, he's got the time, he's well organized, you know, he gets stuff done. And I think we'll give him a go with this one.
Well, that's an opportunity that John has to take advantage of.
That's right. You know, but if John's also, but John can improve his chances by going out and reading and talking about it with it, you know, and being known as somebody who's researched on it because the boss said we're going to do a project next year on, you know, InfiniBand. So he goes out and reads up on InfiniBand and comes back to work and goes to the boss and says, you know, actually that InfiniBand stuff's pretty cool. I was reading about it. And then, you know what, the boss sits there and then 3 months later he goes, well, John's done some reading. Let's get him involved in the project. That's how you get ahead.
True.
Is that luck? Is that luck?
No, it's taking advantage of opportunities.
It's initiative too. It's the person that's driven enough to keep up and make something happen for themselves. There may be once in a while you're in the right place at the right time, but you probably got to that right place at that right time because you were on a path that got you there. And that path involves study and reading and hard work and keeping up with your job. And there's a difference between the guy who's got his face in a book reading and who's studying blogs or maybe writing them, and the guy who is just happy to go to work 9 to 5 and come home at the end of the day and forget about it.
I make more money because there's people like that, period, right? If there's someone that just wants to work 9 to 5, 8 to 5, and there are people like that. And, you know, we could go on to this, and there's two things I want to talk about based on what you just said. What's the future of books as related to learning, as you wrote me, and can online learning replace books, right? And all of this is the same thing. And what you're saying, do people that want to work 9 to 5, do they – can they learn doing online training without having to work harder? Or do we need books? Do we need to study books? You know, I guess it goes without saying, of course, we'll need hands-on experience and get out in the field and do all this. So we'll leave that alone. But let's just talk about the difference for a minute between online learning, whether it's ebooks, you know, online modules, online audio or video, or actual hardbound books. There's been many studies. One of them that I used at Duke University and one here at CU. I'm out of Boulder, Colorado, and it was huge difference between people of retention rates. There was a 90% retention rate of people that are actually reading and absorbing books and taking the time to study out of actual physical books than on e-learning websites, you know, and so on. And, you know, you go back to that study that was originally done 2008, is Google making us stupid? And the answer is a resounding yes. It absolutely is, because we get more and more information thrown at us every day. And this is one of the hardest things, because we have to get up every day and put on filters. Every day I get up and filters. You know, people are like, how do you do this? How do you focus on this? Because I don't search the web. I don't get on the webs. And, you know, I'm going to go back to my 1981 experience with Atari. All the way from then up until now, I've never played a video game in my entire life. I'm 50 years old and not touched one video game. So I don't spend my time playing video games. I don't spend myself just browsing, looking on the web. I don't do Facebook. I don't do Twitter. Certainly, I use social media for work, but I have someone do it, you know, for my businesses. So I limit my internet capability. In other words, I don't just get on the internet for nothing. I do. I go out there for work, and absolutely, email is king for me. Email is everything that I do. But
let me ask you a question about that. I've got a theory about that, about learning from books, which I'd just like to run past you as somebody who's probably got a lot more experience about it than me. I figure that when I went to school, I was taught how to read out of a book. And if I remember rightly, in my day, I was actually taught to put my finger under the word and read across the page, right?
Yes.
And I think one of the things that I found that is that when I first started reading from a screen, or from, you know, 20 years ago, I didn't learn from a screen. But then I took some time to focus on on my thinking process, on my absorption process from the screen, and to train myself to stop and slow down and read, and then to read. You know, when you go, I learned how to speed read when I went to university, and I actually had to stop and crack the speed reading habit and go back to the reading word by word, and then relearn how to speed read on a screen. Because I have this theory is that your brain was taught that the only way to absorb information is from paper held in your hand, and there's something about it's like an interstitial mind lock, which actually says, now I'm in absorption mode. And that was from, you know, 18 years of education at a university. And I had to break that habit and say that reading on the screen is the same thing. I think you can retrain your mind to learn from reading from a screen.
It is necessarily true that what you're saying, Greg, but there is a fundamental study of the hertz not matching how our eyes can match with them and our neurons, the way that we're reforming our neurons. There's huge studies on this that I've done, and I won't get into it on this one. But let me ask you guys a question, And based on you guys have this blog website and how I look at websites and how people look at websites, Greg, and you're probably different than most people I've talked to about this. Mm-hmm. If someone's out there and they're listening to this, when was the last time you went to a website and actually read the whole website? Or did you just scan it for information or URLs and click that link and go somewhere else? Interesting stuff. And that's what we're learning to do, is to scan and to learn quickly. And then, interesting enough, we're not absorbing the material, but we're thinking that we're feeling smarter. But we're actually, since our brains are somewhat elastic, in other words, we're learning how to just look at material and glean from it and not actually absorb it. So,
Todd, I can say that I'm somewhat guilty of what you're saying. Yes. I consume via RSS. I have many blogs that I subscribe to. And it's more of a filtration process that I go through. I don't read everything. I couldn't possibly. If I sat here all day, every day, I couldn't read every article that was posted out there, what I would call properly. So I scan by titles that are interesting. I scan then and see if I care. If I care, then I read it in detail and try to absorb it all. And what I read and absorb all of would be one article in 20, would say, something like that.
Which might be fine, because the fact is you're scanning to get to the meat of what you need, because we cannot – if we try to absorb everything that was thrown at us, I mean, we talk about information overload. I mean, talk about anxiety and why Xanax sells so much. Well, we got so much information.
There's way too much. I mean, between – if you look at Twitter, it's just a waterfall of information. You can't keep up with it all. You pick out this and that. Google Plus is the same thing, and I'm only on Facebook under duress. I don't use it.
But you know what? Interesting, Facebook said that 20% of their users are on 18 hours a day, or active, not just signed in, active 18 hours a day.
I don't have a problem with that, right? Because I think there are people in the world who don't have a lifestyle which is like ours. We work in an environment where the learning and focus is a core skill. When I say that, I mean when you're sitting in front of a router and you're about to change somebody's OSPF, routing configuration, your focus needs to be like absolute on that particular task. Now, if you're a receptionist who sits on the front desk and your job is to smile at 5,000 people as they walk straight past you and go into the lifts and walk away all day, you don't really need to have that sort of focus to, you know, pay attention to one thing for an extended period of time. That's a skill that different jobs have.
Okay, right? But Greg, there's been some studies on this that people are learning to have virtual relationships. And what this receptionist or this guy or this woman is doing is they're learning now to build virtual relationships, not actual physical relationships like we did when we were younger and as we went through high school and college. People are no longer doing that. They're building online virtual relationships, which is basically, again, we're going off onto an emotional, you know, thing of what the internet does to us, which I'm not sure that this webinar was about that. But you know what?
It's a fascinating topic, because
it's very fascinating. It is.
One of the things is if you are studying of any, you will spend, you know, 10, 15 hours a week, say, conservatively investing in your career development, right? In my case, it's a little bit more. Other people might have a little bit less, whatever it is. One of the things that I get really annoyed about is people who sit there saying, I'm reading the textbook and then all of a sudden you see a message come up on the Twitter saying, oh, I was watching the football, so-and-so did something. I'm going, you can't study, you can't absorb information if you're not focused on it. You can't have television.
No, I've blogged about exactly this. I did a blog post on my personal blog, actually, about how to get things done when you're a busy person. And one of the points I made was you have to stay focused on a particular task. Shut off the TV, close down Twitter, stay away from your email, and pay attention to the one task that it is that you've got in your outline that you need to get done that day to achieve your goal. If you don't stay focused, it's not going to get done.
Absolutely. When I was just over in London, I was speaking at some universities, and one of the things I told people is that I get up every day and I make a bullet point, probably more of what I can get done each day, but I make a bullet point and I hyper-focus on those and I take out anything else that comes up to me and I just turn them off. I don't keep my browser up. But let me ask you guys a question based on that last conversation we just had. When was the last time either one of you have read a book other than a computer book?
I read one fiction book a fortnight.
I haven't read anything fiction for quite some time, but I do read. I have other interests.
And Ethan, that's the other thing. But okay, but a fortnight, what is that, 4 nights?
4 2 weeks.
That's pretty darn good. That is way above average. Do you know that?
Well, what happens is it's pretty simple. I have a system of watching out for books, and whenever I see a book that I might like, I will put it onto a list in my to-do list, and then every now and then I'll go and look at my to-do, and I'll wait a year for the books to come down in price, and then a year later I'll have no idea why I put that book there. I'll have read a review, or somebody will have mentioned it, or whatever, and I'll go to a website. There's a website called thebookdepository.co.uk, and they sell books half price, free shipping. The only disadvantage is it can take 2 or 3 weeks for them to arrive because I don't know, they must get them out of a warehouse in, you know.
But that's way above average, and Ethan's right. I mean, some other thing, like I'll try to play guitar or something like that. But yeah. I try to do anything. But what I try to get these younger kids to understand is to focus on what they want to do. Because what you're talking about, Ethan, on your other blog, you got to focus on what you're doing and keep all the other distractions, turn them off, and also make sure that okay, I do want to be on Facebook, I do want to be on Twitter, that I limit that per day. Okay, so let me keep moving on here.
Here's the other thing you do. I don't run an email client.
Really?
I have an email, but I only turn it on when I'm breaking.
I couldn't run my business. I might be making fun of people on Facebook, but then I'm sitting here saying all I can do is email. I have that up 24/7.
Todd, we can transition.
And I would work for 2 hours on something, and then when I'm finished, I will turn email on and I will answer emails for a period of time and then turn it off again.
Todd, we can transition this whole topic of self-discipline and focus into another question here, which is a lot of people that are out there thinks that certification is the answer to IT success. And I mean, you're heavily invested in helping people get certifications. So what are your thoughts on that?
The answer is I'm not trying to sell books here. I'm trying to say, you know, I'm working on new certs. I'm working on new technologies. I'm trying to do the data center because, you know, although you know, most people would say, well, I have the experience, I don't need certs and all that. We actually need both. And, you know, if we do have an issue in the future, and, you know, I know the times, financial times are difficult. I tell you what, I got someone that called me that we were teaching a CCNP voice and from Chicago, and they said, I need to hire 36 CCNP voices. I'm like, I got people in here, but I don't think they have any experience. He goes, I don't care. I need them. They need to be certified to keep their gold partnership or whatever. They actually flew to Dallas and interviewed people in class. So that might give you some indication. I've been sitting there advertising these voice classes going, hey, you guys want some jobs? There's people from San Antonio and Houston and again, Chicago and DC. I just got one from Maryland. They need voice, you know, so I'm not going to try to push voice on people because I'm not a voice guy. I'm a wireless guy and I don't like VoIP for anything. But I tell you what, if someone was out looking for a job and you get your VoIP certs, you can get a job right now. So what does that answer a question? I mean, so the answer is, should we, you know, build a foundation based on, you know, hard work? Sure, like we have, you know, so I mean, my foundation is strong, but the certifications on top of that is absolutely needed because
When you're early in your career, certainly certifications help you get off the ground for sure. That's how I got started. My first consulting job came because I was working with Novell at the time. See, I'm not as old as you guys, but I'm still old. So anyway, working on Novell certs, doing certified network administration kind of stuff, getting that certification enabled me to get into a consulting job. And then that turned into a whole career from there. And I continued to get certifications along the way because not only does it expose you to new information, things you didn't know before, and it presumably will demonstrate a particular level of competency that you can then put on a resume or a CV and go to a prospective employer and say, look, I certified at this level, and now beat me up in the interview and let me prove to you that I actually know what I'm talking about, not just the certification says I do.
That's a really good point. So, you know, I don't know how the Microsoft certs are going because I stopped doing Microsoft a long time ago, but the Cisco certs, and I don't know how much you guys have kept up with those, they're extremely difficult. You know, they're not, and I'm talking about the written ones, Ethan. The CCIE obviously is different and much harder.
The CCIE written, which I have to take every 2 years to recert, it's kind of a joke that it's a trivia exam. It's not so much about how competent you are with networking technologies and more what esoteric little facts you can keep in your head and do you have enough of them in your head to get through the test and recertify. Sure. And it seems like Cisco's kind of been in a sense, I think they've been forced to go out of their way to make the test ridiculously difficult because of cheating and so on that's gone on.
Well, let me give an example on the CCNA, which is their most popular certification, 2 million tests a year. They make a lot of money off CCNA. They just raised the price $300. They're really unfair. But anyways, that being said, they change their tests, complete tests, every 5 days now, you know, based because they can charge enough and they get enough people. So, you know, they are really trying to get rid of the paper certs, I guess. I don't even use that word anymore, but, you know, I don't even know what's out there. You know, there used to be Test King or some crap like that, but I don't even know what's out there anymore. But they do all sorts of things to stop people from doing that. And I there is no way that someone could practice on practice question, you know, cheat sheets or whatever they're called, and pass the test. It's not going to happen. You know, their bank of questions is just so large, it just wouldn't happen. You know, so I teach a CCNA class. We do 6 days, and you know, and we're going 12, 14 hours a day. You know, and this is after 3 months of pre-study, you know, so they do online training and videos and all this other stuff. So it is not a simple cert. So I don't know how all the other certs are. I used to be, you know, teaching certifications and be certified and all this and consulting and all sorts of different things, the Microsoft and even Novell, as you said, but the Cisco. But now you have to specialize. You really do, because that's how hard and how the technology has evolved. You know, things have gotten so difficult. You have to evolve. You have to specialize in VoIP. It's really hard to be them all. And Ethan, when you were saying you're Novell, but you were also probably the Ethernet guy, you know, and maybe even the Microsoft guy as they started out. You know, we used to be able to go do it all, you know, and Token Ring probably still had. But and I certainly was when I was consulting, but that's pretty difficult to do today.
Yeah, my earlier jobs were definitely that way, where you had the ability to be able to take it all in and kind of see the system as a whole, not just the underpinning, not just the underlying network, but also the servers, also the workstations and the operating systems and the software that you ran on those operating systems. But keep a handle on it. You could kind of keep up with it because the amount of information you need to know just wasn't quite so vast. Yep. Now these same, we're basically using the same products we did a decade or a decade and a half ago. They've just evolved. And it's that evolution that's made them so broad and so much more detail and so many features that have been pumped into them that it becomes impossible to keep up with it all. I mean, I'm wanting to get into VMware and virtualization this year and add that to my plate. I feel like I need to know that. A lot of what VMware is doing is bleeding over into the networking space. So I want to go down that road. And it's like, man, it's not like I don't have enough to keep up with already. And I want to add that.
So on top of that, Cisco's really going to be pushing the Fibre Channel now for their – you know, for their fabrics, you know, for their server fabrics. I mean, that's really where it's going. We are still, I like to say we're using our grandfather's networks right now. It's really disappointing to me to see people running 10/100 on any network. I mean, even our wireless can run faster than that. So, you know, 802.11n, if it's built correctly, you know, you could do more than 100 megabits per second. You know, so, you know, what are we supposed to, you know, our switches, our foundation, our everything in our corporate networks are so far behind, but they're going to have to catch up quickly because, Greg, you brought that up at the very beginning about that our networks can't keep up with the data. And so we already have bottlenecks on our routers and our switches right now.
I don't want to overstate that. I mean, you can overblow that, right? There's two things going on. One is I was around in the late 90s when we used to have, you know, Bay Networks and Nortel and Cisco and 3Com and Force Systems and David Systems and Chipcom and all those different companies all making different networking products. And I remember starting out and it was so difficult to understand what all the different products did and all that sort of stuff. And then I think what we've actually had since about 2003, 2004, the networking industry just stagnated. And in the last 7-8 years, we've had no change. We've been able to learn everything inside of the networking industry. We've just not – I mean, Ethernet. It's been 1 gig for like how long? Since 2004, really. And the protocols we've had, spanning tree, OSPF, BGP, ISIS, for how long? 20 years? What's changed? And I think part of what you're seeing there is the human resistance to change, where we're not used to new things happening in networking and – we're all going, oh, all these new technologies. But I remember in the late 90s, we were server guys. We were networking guys. We were cabling guys. We used to all walk around with our own cabling gear because we could make our own cables and it was trivial to do. It wasn't hard. I think it's just a case of we've gotten used to being something else, knowing our networks back to front. But in the meantime, our server guys didn't know every single server in the network and know every single, you know, DLL that was loaded on their Windows server or every, you know, driver on their Linux box. Then they learned to control a non-controlled environment. And the storage industry is suffering from the same problem. They've had 10 years of nothing changed, you know. Stack a few more disks in, upgrade a bit of this, and then run with it, you know.
Nothing changed. If we could get people to push in, one of the disappointments I've seen, I think, in the last 5 years is we haven't been able to migrate to IP version 6 as fast as we should have, because then we would have OSPF-E3, which I think is going to, you know, with its mobility features and its header, it's a phenomenal routing protocol, and it's router-aware routing. You know, right now we're doing what Cisco's dead time by default is 40 seconds. We're going to be able to go to microseconds. Mm-hmm. You know, so that is a huge difference in our network convergence time. You know, so I think IPv6, we need bigger, better networks, because, you know, with the tow cards and with IP version 6, we're sending data. When I say we run our grandfather's network, you know, we're still doing what's the PDU data segments, packets, frames, bits, for God's sakes, you know, we can't send any data like that anymore.
If you want to know about running your grandfather's network, why are people still using copper? You know, we were supposed to have fiber optics in the 2000s, you know? And yet I walked into a data center the other day and they said, no, we're running Cat 6 copper everywhere. And I looked at them and went, why? Are you stupid? What, you know, anyway, I agree, yes. So I think there's a lot of staticness, and the certifications have tricked us into thinking that we knew everything. Or we knew enough to know everything. Like what we didn't know, we could rapidly iterate in, because there wasn't a lot that we didn't have a good grounding in. You know, there was a time back in 2004, 2005 where you were a switching guy or a routing guy. You were very rarely both. Does that make sense?
And it was a routing guy. But, you know, I tell you, I study IPv6 a lot, and I really wish our world. You know, whoever came up with NAT, I wish I could go back in time and do a Terminator on them, you know, go back Terminator and get rid of, you know, PAT, port address translation, so it never came out. We'd have been forced to go to IP version 6, you know, a decade ago. I think our world would be different. We'd probably even have peace in the Middle East, for God's sakes. I mean, we're talking about our world would be totally different night and day. That IPv6 is so much better. You know, with that being said, of course, it fixes all the inaccuracies of IP version 4, but you got to remember that I think IP version 4 sucks. It really has some problems. It was never built to be Zoom networks.
It was always built to be a 32-bit, because that was the maximum size of words segment that our CPU architectures could handle. You couldn't load more than 32 bits off a wire into a shift register.
With IP version 6, we will see I think we'll see a whole new group of problems, but hold on. With that being said, how many people made a career because Bill Gates sold a Microsoft solution that didn't exist, right? Many people made a whole career in corporations running Microsoft, just putting in fixes to make this Microsoft work as we were supposed to make it work.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the same thing with IPv6. Of course, and I mean more technically, and I certainly more low level. I mean, getting down, IPv6 is easy on the high level, but harder on the low level. So, you know, I think we're going to see a whole bunch of new problems and security issues and all these things that haven't come to fruition because it hasn't been implemented, you know, in any type of huge manner. And so I would love to see that. That would be a career if someone was starting out. IPv6 would be great. But honestly, and one of the questions, Ethan, that you were asking me is, I want to get to this one here. What's the skills are in future for the important?
And, you know, right. I mean, we can – IPv6 just came up. We just hammered on that, and that's obvious. And I think 2012, we're going to see a lot more of an uptake in IPv6. So people that are getting started in their networking careers, particularly if they embrace IPv6, that's going to be good for their careers.
Sure.
Beyond that, what else do you say is hot, Todd?
That's where I was trying to head. Really, you want to go to the core data center, because – you know, as we go more towards the cloud, and I don't care if anybody's listening to this, they don't like it. That's just the way it's going to be. And the fact is if you're out working at a corporation, you know, and they have 5 sites and all this, one of the questions you asked me is, when is it time to move on to a different employer? I tell you when it is, when you can get a job in a large enterprise network, a larger network. Now, you might have to take less money. You might have to start at a lower position. But you want to get an enterprise level, because the person that's still working at, say, a corporation that's, you know, not even the Fortune 10,000 or something like that, those are going to go away. Everything's going to be managed offsite, you know, every device. And we probably won't even have PCs, right? Who knows what type of media it's going to be, and who cares what the media is going to be. a lot of people say the laptop's going to be gone by 2015 completely. No hard drives, everything's going to be connected, you know, to this worldwide semantic network. So it was like, okay, you know, we got the Web 3.0 coming out, and that's going to – they're going to dictate the kind of media which will be no hard drive and how you're going to get on that and so on. And we want to –
I can't see – somebody who's been in the industry as long as you – I find it hard to believe that you think the cloud is the final end game. I see the cloud as the next transition. I mean, I remember the mainframe, everything in the central, nothing at the edge. And then the pendulum swung back the other way, and then we had netware and PCs on desks.
Okay.
Then the pendulum swung back the other way, and then it was and the netware all moved into the data center. And then the pendulum swung back the other way, and we put all the servers back in the edge of the network, so every office had its own server. And then it swung back the cloud is just another phase of centralization. It's a little bit different to what we've had before, but it doesn't look any different to me. And I think that as hardware development accelerates and battery technology improves, you'll have local computing again within 5-8 years. There's no reason to believe that it won't. People will say, why are we making big fat chunks of power consumption go to a data center in Delaware? Why don't I just put it in my house and have it distributed all around the place so I don't actually have to have a single point of failure?
Yeah, you very well may be right. I'm only telling you what I work on now. Yeah. And, you know,
we're seeing now is that clouds are moving into hardware acceleration. So up until today, clouds have been places where everything's done in software. And because it's in software, it's easy to change and to add new features.
Yeah. But let me tell you, let me add on to what I was saying, though. With some of the changes in technology and the way Cisco's doing their fiber channel and the way that their storage and even some of the stuff you were talking about earlier, Greg, no one's going to be able to afford to do that on site. You know, for example, I went into the cloud with my company a couple of years ago. Honestly, I just don't think I could afford it or want to take the money to come back and put all my servers back on site. It's not cost effective.
Hang on. What is it that makes your servers not cost effective? The crappy software that runs on them?
I have to manage them. I'd have to have a server. I don't have any server rooms now. I don't have anyone.
So the thing that makes the cloud possible is the software that makes it easier to manage them.
Okay, so we've got VMware. And we've got Windows Server 2008.
They're just interim steps. They're just iterations of a previous generation of technology. So what will happen, in my view, is that we'll move into the cloud. The cloud will enable development of a whole bunch of really advanced software that'll be sophisticated and rich. And then as it matures, we'll crack it into smaller pieces and put it back in the house or into phones or desktop computers.
Well, that's to be seen because, great, let's say that we had some social breakdowns. And I go over to London and work a lot. They got some social lows. It's not going to take much to have some social breakdown over there. It could transfer over here. And we're just talking about another subject, not some Armageddon scenario, just some scenarios where the government wants more control than they have now. These are doomsday, terrible scenarios to even talk about. But you could assume that this is a possibility. And if that's the case, they may force a cloud type structure on us. You know, and I'm not saying I'm not a doomsday guy. The world is over. The Mayan calendar. I'm not saying any of that. I don't think any of that's going to happen. But you could see my point on this.
I can see your point. But what I'm also pointing out is that the longer history, the 40-year cycle of IT has been from central to decentral to central. And quite frankly, I just see cloud as a swing back to central. And it's only a matter of time until it swings back the other way.
Okay. Well, let's say even though maybe you're right.
And history has proven that beyond doubt.
Okay, even though you may be right, I'm making money from data center. People, there are a lot of people, they need data center help. It is hard to find an experienced data center guy or person that can run a huge ISP, we'll call them an ISP, right? So, and connect up autonomous systems together worldwide. So when I just put together a company, I got hired as a consultant, and I just put together this huge network. And what did I use? I used the Amazon cloud, and I used them as the back end, and I used I didn't use the Amazon cloud as the front end because they're really their front end is kind of quirky. I used Rackspace, the front end, which is really easy to use. So I'm not advertising either one of the other guys. Please understand that. But I'm just saying what I did. The back end on Amazon is awesome. And guess what? It's worldwide. I mean, how many data centers do they have? My network should never go down. Of course, I said that, and Amazon went down like the next day right after I told them that, right? Because I mentioned their whole world went down. But needless to say, you know, they've got their redundancy of their redundancy of their redundancy went down. It down. So I was pretty embarrassed. But nonetheless, I still see that I'm selling that solution and it works. It's not like I'm selling vaporware here. I'm selling Amazon or a cloud scenario and putting it up there. And it's easy. These guys can manage it from anywhere. And they don't have to worry about someone going into the server at midnight because the servers went down or the server room lost power, none of that. So there is a lot of advantages to this. And there's a lot of advantages. And let me speak as a networking guy here, as a Cisco guy. You know, I'm studying data center right now. One, because I like it, you know, and I do wireless. I do wireless. I do data center, you know, and I do certification also because that's part of my core business. You know, I'll leave VoIP up for someone else, you know, and some of the other, you know, security for another guru. So you have to specialize. And one of the things I want to specialize is more Nexus, more Fibre Channel, more VMware. You know, Ethan, we were all talking about this before we got on. And that's one of your goals as well.
Yeah, the thing about the data center, I mean, you were talking about great big worldwide data centers, but much of this technology is trickling down even into the smaller setups. A lot of times, all a big data center is just a pod that's replicated 100 or 1,000 times. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that's what I've seen in my experience. And then, you know, so you end up with all of those technologies, everything you were just talking about, Fibre Channel, fabric in whatever flavor that is, whether that's Cisco Nexus, if you want to call that a fabric, to what Juniper's doing and so on. And you can just replicate it on a much smaller scale. So everybody up and down the line, if you're working at a company of any size, having data center skills, being able to build out an infrastructure that's going to support not just data, but also your storage in a converged way.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a career maker there.
Yeah. And, you know, and IPv6. So, you know, I tell everyone, hey, I get a lot of VoIP requests, huge amount. That's my number one. The next is data center. And then I say, study IPv6, because regardless of someone's not asking for it now, don't you want to be there when someone does? And I mean, it's an inevitability, wouldn't you? And Greg, you would agree with that one.
I think voice is over. I think voice is in demand now because but the real time to have been in it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
You don't really mean it's over so much as it's just changing, it's shifting around a bit, I think.
I think that, you know, if you were, well, two things, and this is probably a relevant discussion, is that don't get caught up on the fact that once you get voice, you'll be done for the next 40 years of your career, because you won't. I believe that IP telephony will be around for about another 5 years, maybe 10, until everybody gets mobile phones. And why would you have a phone on your desk anyway? So I think the current fad for telephones on desks is a quaint American thing, because in Europe, we just don't get them. We don't use them. They don't even put phones on the desk. They issue you with a mobile and you get a desk somewhere in the building and that's it. We don't even get phones on desks. And so don't, but what that would suggest to you is, you know, in 10 years ago, it was some other technology, you know, it was frame relay, being a frame relay switching expert, and it'll be some other technology in the future. Remember that if you pass a voice and you become a voice guy today, that in 10 years' time, it'll probably be moving on to something else, well, whatever that is.
We can say that about any technology. I mean, NDS, I was an NDS expert without a doubt. And does anybody care right now? Nobody. And I made a lot of money from that at the time. We always have to evolve. And that's one thing about this career, I guess, you know, having ADD is helpful in this career because it's constantly changing. And, you know, and we talked about earlier when it changed slower and we could know everything. Now it changes daily, which as I'm getting older is harder to keep up. And so, you know, your point, Greg, is understood, but we've been doing that our whole careers and we will continue to do that. You know, but look at how long IP version 4 lasts. You don't think someone can make a career? I'll turn this back on to you. You don't think someone can make a career off IP version 6, you know, right now for probably the next 20 years?
Yeah, sure. But IPv6 is a foundation, not a vertical. So IP telephony runs on top of IPv6.
All of that would have to change. So you're not going to hurt anything by doing IPv6. All right, we can agree on that.
I think the point is that just because you remember that, this is not the decision you make to get into a certification or a technology is just one in a series of decisions you'll make for the rest of your life. And don't trick yourself into thinking, I'll just do this the once. It's something that you'll have to do over and over and over.
I think anybody would be a fool to think like that. And I'm not sure that anyone has been thinking like that. But I'm just also just giving information based on what I learn every day. People are looking for $150,000 to pay a VoIP guy. I mean, right now, people aren't gonna shy away from that. And if they don't evolve from that, we talked about that earlier. If they don't take you know, the opportunities that evolve from that into the new, we're going to go from SIP to whatever.
And we then don't have that. So here in Europe, we don't have the same demand for voice people.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's right. It's huge.
It's regional. I think there's a cult. I would guess, I have no foundation for this knowledge except for discussions that I have with engineers. I think there's something in American businesses where the PABX has some special status, or is. Whereas here in Europe, I think the carrier market is different, and mobile phones are cheap. And
if you want a job in America by summer, and you get your voice search, you're going to have a job. Period. And then you want to get. And here is the thing. Okay, the other question you asked me, Ethan, was. You quit your job or whatever. And I still want to stay focused on that. You still want to do enterprise, even if Greg was right and we go back to where we're decentralized, you know, instead of centralized, wouldn't make any difference, because when we become decentralized again, it's going to be all new technology, right? So right now and for the near future, I would have to say the cloud, VoIP, and certainly IPv6 is something, and I like VMware as well, is something that I certainly focus on. You know, so, and I believe that that's something that everyone should strive for right now. And then
the success of cloud, where it's going to go, I think is going to have a lot to do with how the security paradigms come down over the next few years. That's the big open-ended element of putting your data up in the cloud, that people are continuing to ask questions, hard questions, and not getting great answers yet. How is their data being secured when it's up there? Yeah. And so that, I mean, I have to imagine you have people coming at you looking for security experts too, Todd.
Not as much, but there certainly are people that ask for security experts. But I don't, you know, I was just giving you my experience on what I hear every day. I'm not saying that, and I think, I don't know if you missed, if Greg, I don't know how I said, maybe I misspoke, that I don't think that anything is a long-term solution. Everything is a stepping stone or stepping board, you know, to get to something. To your career.
I only really said that because a lot of the people who write to Ethan and I and say, you know, what should I do with my career, and should I do this or should I do that? And one of the things that the messages I would always like to share with people is, remember that whatever choice you make, it's only temporary, because you'll have to pick something else in some time. Now, by all means, you know, make your decision about which technology you're going to go into. You might choose IP telephony because that's the hot technology and you want to do that. That's great. Go and invest in a training course. Go and get into that game. That's absolutely fantastic. Support that. But you might also look around and say, actually, I work for a company that has an MPLS backbone. I'll get MPLS certs because I can get practical experience here and get a leg up. You know, there's multiple choices. And then, but once you've got MPLS, remember that it might be replaced with, I don't know, some other technology in the next few years, and you would have to move on. But, you know, whatever, be flexible, be open, keep moving.
Absolutely. And that's what we constantly have to do. So, and that's what we're constantly doing. And it strives, and it takes time, which makes it hard to, you know, balance your work and family. And, you know, and I think you asked me something about that as well.
Well, I mean, there's a challenge that everybody has when you're a busy person, you've got a full-time job and you've got a family and you want these certifications. How do you go after that? And I think we've really kind of covered it with all the other things that we've been talking about. It's focus, it's time management, it's building a list of tasks to do, getting it done, not watching TV, you know, and all those sorts of things. It can be done, but you've got to prioritize in your life and weed out the cruft. What's not important? Get rid of it.
Yeah, I think maybe we did touch on it. No video games. You know, things like that. I don't think they're going to give you any value in your IT search.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a practical question, just for those people who might be, you know, looking at this as for terms of practical advice. I'm a huge fan of flashcards. So I have a flashcard library which now runs to 2,500 cards. And I will try. And I will try and run those cards. I'll try and get through those cards as often as I can. So I'll actually sit in front of my computer for 15 minutes at maybe twice a day and just hit card after card after card as a way of enforcing knowledge. It doesn't work very well, but I'm trying.
Well, okay, but here's what I put so my teaching style, and I'll just give you my experience, because I think that's what you asked me. Mm-hmm. I don't just do lecture in a day, or we don't just do hands-on. We do a lot of different things. So if someone's going to come to me for a class, or if someone is self-studying, here's what I tell them they have to do. On the same subject, so on one particular subject, you're going to get, if you come to class, a lecture, then you're going to do hands-on labs, and then you're going to do written labs, and then you're going to do video, and then reading. So do you see there's all these different ways to do it? And the flashcards would go under the written lab section. So you can't do any one way and learn. So, you know, the way that I teach people to learn the certifications, to learn through CLASC, is build the foundation. Because you can't teach people an exam cram and get them to pass an exam. That's foolish. It's never going to happen. Plus, then again, they wouldn't get through the interview stage, as we talked about. But a second part is, they have to learn and get it in their mind all different ways. And a lot of it comes down to they read my book, then they do written exams, hands-on labs, and I have them do repetition of hands-on labs as well. So repetition of everything. But flashcards is just one tool out of an arsenal that you should have when you're studying. You know, lecture, whether it's, you know, online or real, or ILT, hands-on labs, practice exams, flashcards, written labs, the videos. I use videos as well as a learning tool to supplement instructor-led training, to catch something that maybe I missed as I went through. And then again, reading. So I have them read the details. So all of those together, if you take a particular subject and say, I'm going to do all of these different ways of learning, you will absorb the material. You can't take one thing and say, I'm going to read this book and I'm going to be able to pass a test and go pass and go take an interview. You know, we have to learn. Now, I have met people that can do that. When I was in school, there are people that are just academic like that, but 99% of us aren't. The other five nines, right? 99.99. We need to learn and absorb in all different facets. So if people are studying for their certification, they're studying to grow their career, they're studying a new technology, I go all different ways. I do definitely learn some Cisco online training. I definitely read books. I definitely read online. I definitely look at practice test questions, as you said. You know, those practice test questions help you think about the technology that you just read. So that's great, flashcards and all that. But again, it's one tool in your arsenal, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I do it. And I actually have a version, I have a program which replicates to my iPhone and my iPad. So I'll even, you know, be in the crapper flipping through a flashcard station. Maybe that's too much information.
No, there's no maybe about it. That was too much information. That's
great. Yeah.
Well,
we've
Greg,
got a little time. Do you think anybody's still listening to us?
Well, Greg, just a comment on what you were saying about flashcards. My own version of that is I like to go to Bosin, who puts out legitimate practice exams with notes and so on. I will buy one of their practice exams and then go through those questions, essentially flashcard style. I look at the question. Do I know the answer? Yes or no? If I don't know it, then that's my jumping off point. All right, I got to go read and figure out what the heck it is that I don't know, and then go back through them. And their test engine mixes up the questions and the answers so you don't get into a rut of just answering A, B, C in some particular order because you've seen the questions so many times. You're forced to read them and reconsider every time so that you give the correct answer and truly understand the information. Other things that I've done is build tree structures of data where you've got a high-level topic like EIGRP, and then underneath that, you know, subtopics that all break down and may end up at a URL where I would need to go for the rest of the information, so that it's all compartmentalized and containerized in such a way that I can review a topic very quickly by looking at the tree.
One other quick thing on that. Cisco Press started putting out this test engine that when you got a question wrong, it told you what book to go to and what page. And so Cybex Wiley, my published, the only reason I know this is because Cybex Wiley said, oh, we're going to do this with your book. So they're coming out with this test engine that when you read it and you miss a question or you want to look up more information, it actually tells you what page to go to. That's interesting. That's an interesting test engine, I think.
Well, I think the key there for any of this is if you're one of these people that wants to get through the test, the key is to learn the material. And so yes, when you fail that question, you don't just go, I got to memorize the answer to that question. No. You got to go back and read the information so you understand it, so that it doesn't matter what questions presented to you on the actual exam, you will know the information and be able to get the right answer because you know what the heck you're talking about. You didn't memorize an answer that goes with some question.
Right. And here's the key. I tell my students, I said that I can get perfect score on this test, and here's why. I know why all the other answers are wrong. You can't always tell on a Cisco test why an answer is right. Trust me, they write them pretty funky. But you should be able to, by your foundation, know why all the answers are wrong. All the other answers are wrong. So, and you only learn that by knowing a strong foundation.
Well, guys, we've been going on for about an hour, so what do we say we wrap it up? Because, yeah, I don't know, Todd. I don't know if anyone's still listening or not, but for those people that are... Now, Todd, it sounds like, you know, your life is busy enough that do you blog? It sounds like you don't do Twitter or any of those things. But
I do it, but not personally. You know, I'll send out when I was over in London, I was blogging, hey, I'm on a train from Manchester or Birmingham or wherever I was coming from, and I'm drinking a beer, you know, drinking a pint, you know, I was in first class. It was kind of nice. You know, I'll do every once in a while, I'll put in a personal thing. But for the most part, I use social media for work. You know, I never use it for personal.
And so if people want to follow you, Todd Lamley, what should they follow?
Yeah, I mean, they got Facebook, you know, I got my fan page, and then I got Twitter at Lamley. And I got my YouTube channel is the most popular. I got more subscribers because I put out videos on there. I cut some of my videos out and put them on there, you know, pieces here and there. So I got a lot of YouTube. YouTube's the best place to go. It's a great search engine now anyways. You know, so I think I get a lot of people that correspond with me through YouTube. You know, so, but of course I'm Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, I don't know what else. Sorry, I pay someone for that. So, but I don't use it personally to talk to anything. I don't have any friends on Facebook. You know, it's like I said, my fan page.
Gotcha. All right. Well, yeah. Mr. Farrell, what are you going to be up to this week?
I am going to be writing stuff for people. So I have a number of writing projects for the people that I write commercially for, and I'll probably be writing a lot more blog posts because and I've got to wrap up some video around the OpenFlow webinar I did last week, and that will be me. So an odd week for me.
Yeah, I'll be finishing up a Nexus build sheet for a project that we're doing, and got my own blogging to do, a whole bunch of blogs in the queue, and although I don't do as much commercial writing as you, I do a little bit. I'm getting started on that, and I have some articles due. And hey, for everyone that's listening, those few of you that are still left, we thank you very much for listening to the show this week. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show. Hey, if you're on Clout, Greg and I would appreciate it if you'd send some Ks our way. We are both very influential about unicorns, we'll have you know. Email your questions or comments about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.
Well, you know, we're good on technology, but we're great on unicorns.
The Packet Pushers podcast is delivered on a best effort basis and cannot be held responsible for problems you notice on your network after listening. Excessive jitter, interface flapping, empty toss values, overlapping IP subnets, IPS false positives, stale port descriptions, congested uplinks, broadcast storms, topology loops, flatulence in the hot aisle, clogged fan intakes, failed firmware upgrades, IP fragmentation, lacking IPv6 support, failing line cards, FCOE, soup failovers, missing unicorns, out-of-order packets, keyboard cruft, unlabeled equipment, decaf coffee, catastrophic power failures, rogue access points, and bacon shortages may result and are not our fault. The choice of a networking podcast is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements or disclaimers. The Packet Pushers podcast is copyrighted, all rights reserved. Please tell a friend.